Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the February 5th edition of the County Chronicle. We'll start with the first page stories. Arcola City Council officially approved water rate increases by Ben Crane. The Arcola City Council officially approved their water rate increases in response to the rate changes handed down by Illinois American Water. Sewer rates will not increase. For the first 1,000 gallons, it will cost $17.25, with every 1,000 gallons after costing $11.50 each. Every 1,000 over 50,000 gallons will cost $9.50 each. The sewer rates, which stayed the same, cost $13.25 for the first 1,000, with every 1,000 gallons after costing $9.50 each. Every 1,000 gallons over 5,000 still costs $6. According to city documents, this rate increase will cost the average user, about 4,500 gallons, $99.40. The Employee Relations Committee also met with the regular council meeting, interviewing two current employees for new job titles. The Building and Grounds Committee met after the meeting, approving the sale of surplus equipment at the Tri-County auctions on March 29th. A metal lathe, hydraulic crane, 33 various 1,000 and 1,500 watt lights, fuel tank, Kubota snowblower, push mower, pressure washer, concrete mixer, handheld post hole digger, carpet cleaner, and floor scrubber will be auctioned off. The committee also discussed opening proposals for the Moore Park concession stand back up after not receiving funds from an applied-for grant. Graber Supply and Sturdy Built made proposals in the past, but according to City Administrator Bill Wagoner, proposals need to be updated because they were made a few years ago. When Alderman Brent Budd asked when they should anticipate the stand going up, Wagoner explained that building would begin in September in a perfect world. From the Villa Grove City Council, update on loans and TIF deposits. Administrator Jacqueline Athey noted that she had been working on quarterly reports and that a software glitch had prevented employees' W-2s from printing. She said she was awaiting a callback from the vendor to assess and correct the situation. She then noted that by paying off the Emergency Services Center construction loan early, the city could realize $16,000 in interest savings. Alderman Thelma Blaney questioned whether that savings would offset future interest the money could gain while in the bank, and Athey stated it would. Athey also discussed moving the TIF money to the Villa Grove State Bank from its current repository. Bob Ree then reported that 5th, 6th grade volleyball was ongoing and that youth basketball had recently wrapped up a successful season. He also noted that attendance at the recreation facility had grown by 4 times over the previous months. Finally, he noted that spring sports signups for baseball, softball, and soccer would be available online on February 1st and that the first annual pickleball tournament would take place in mid-March. Chief Cole Tibbetts then reported that one of his officers had sustained an injury which resulted in some missed work and that he and other officers had to adjust their schedules accordingly, with the SRO taking some street shifts while the chief himself covered the school. He also noted that the SRO was scheduled to begin attending training at the following week. Finally, he noted that he had begun to price new squad cars for future purchase. He said that one he had in mind could be fitted for a canine officer if the council were to decide to pursue that option at some point in the future. Public Works Director Mark McSell then reported that his staff was busy doing routine winter maintenance on machinery and that all equipment needed for spring-summer was ready to go. Mayor Ebersol Gunter had no report and moved to new business for the council to discuss. First, Jake Wolf from Engineering Research Associates was on hand to discuss preliminary plans for the pavement project at the community center. Wolf noted that ERA's cost, if the council moved forward with the project, would be $820,000. It was decided that the project should move forward, and the request for proposal will be going on in the near future. A consensus was then reached on having asbestos assessment for a property on West Vine prior to its demolition. Along with this, a consensus was reached to set deadlines for sealed bids for property that the city is set to sell on East Harrison Street. The council then reached a consensus for Director McSell to move forward with a contract in the amount of $3,200 with Fenter Machinery for removal of aquatic vegetation from the west and south sides of the John Leon Reservoir. McSell stated that this removal, along with previously approved aeration, would greatly improve the quality of the body of water. Next, the council approved the TIF loan request submitted by Lauren Anderson for improvements to his Main Street location. The council then determined that purchase of crowd control stanchions for the community center would not be necessary at this time. Finally, Alderman Hooker mentioned the new business boot camp that had been discussed before the pandemic, and it was determined that it remains a viable option for any entrepreneurs who are looking for ways to stabilize or grow their businesses in Villa Grove. The next article, If ICE Comes to School, How Douglas County School Districts Would Handle Immigration Enforcement Actions, by Ben Crane. As concerned about potential immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, actions at schools continue to rise, Douglas County superintendents are considering how their schools would respond if ICE were to arrive seeking, detain, or deport students. In line with recent non-regulatory guidelines from the Illinois State Board of Education, ISBE, all school districts must prioritize the students' rights, including the right to an education, regardless of immigration status. These guidelines recommend that districts establish clear policies on how to handle interactions with immigration authorities. However, local administrators have varied approaches on how to deal with these potential situations. Arcola School District, a firm stand on parental consent. Arcola Superintendent Tom Mulligan expressed that his district approach would closely mirror how it handles any law enforcement request. We don't allow any police or law enforcement to interview students without the parent's consent or the parent present, Mulligan said. If we can't reach the parent or if the parent refuses, we would not allow an interview. Mulligan highlighted that the district would follow existing procedures for releasing student records, ensuring that any request would require parental permission unless a directory information is involved. In the event of emergency, Mulligan explained that the district would work with emergency contacts to ensure students are safe, though the district could not harbor or hold students beyond what the law allows. He also emphasized that the district would continue to focus on creating a safe, compassionate environment for students while navigating the complexities of federal immigration issues. Arthur School Board District, following board policy with flexibility. Superintendent Shannon Cheek of the Arthur School District explained that the district already has a board policy in place for when law enforcement requests interviews with students or access to records. We make every attempt to get hold of parents and have them present for interviews, Cheek said. If a parent gives consent, we will proceed with the interview, but we will not allow law enforcement to interview students without parental involvement. Cheek emphasized that while the district has not yet faced the situation involving ICE, he would be the primary contact if the need arose. He also noted that the district has a flexible policy focusing on supporting the students' well-being. If something were to happen, we would handle it in a way that aligns with our policies and what is best for the student, he said. Tuscola School District, handling each situation individually. Superintendent Gary Alexander from the Tuscola School District said that while he is unaware of any students in the district with uncertain immigration status, the district would treat any such situation on a case-by-case basis. We'll continue to educate all students to the best of our ability, he said. If a situation arises, we'll adapt to it and deal with it individually. Regarding ICE enforcement, Alexander noted that the district is prepared to follow the ISBE guidelines, ensuring student safety while adhering to legal requirements. However, he stated he does not foresee ICE interventions becoming an issue in the district. We will continue to care for and educate all of our students, he affirmed. Villa Grove School District, prioritizing student rights. Villa Grove Superintendent Carol Munson shared that the district has not yet implemented formal steps specifically in response to the ISBE guidelines. However, the administration has discussed how they would approach potential ICE interactions. If a situation were to arise, it would be handled on a case-by-case basis, Munson explained. Always the best interest of the student will be a priority. As with other districts, Villa Grove's approach would center around the protection of students' rights and privacy. Munson added that in the event of an ICE encounter, she would be the point person responsible for managing interactions with federal authorities. We will protect student rights and privacy data as we currently do, she assured. ISBE guidelines ensuring student rights are protected. The Illinois State Board of Education's guidance emphasizes the importance of student rights to education as affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Pillar v. Doe. Under the guidelines, all children in the United States are entitled to a public education regardless of their or their parents' immigration status. The guidance encourages districts to develop clear, locally tailored policies to address potential immigration enforcement actions. This includes adopting procedures for record requests, ensuring staff are trained on how to implement policies, and establishing a point person for handling ICE interactions. Additionally, the guidelines suggest that schools prepare for situations where a student's parent or guardian may be detained or deported. The way forward? In each district, the emphasis remains on prioritizing the well-being and right of students. While the potential for ICE involvement has created uncertainty, local administrators are committed to navigating these issues carefully and with compassion, guided by both legal requirements and their responsibility to care for all students, regardless of their immigration status. In Douglas County, school leaders are focused on fostering environments where students can continue to thrive, irrespective of the challenges that may arise from federal immigration actions. And the final first page story, Alumni Support Helps Tuscola FFA Thrive by Ben Crane. The Tuscola FFA chapter at Tuscola High School has flourished thanks to an ongoing commitment from the Tuscola FFA alumni, who has donated $10,000 in back-to-back years to support the chapter's activities. This substantial contribution plays a vital part in ensuring that every student, regardless of their financial background, has access to important agricultural education experiences. Sarah Shoon, the FFA advisor and agriculture teacher at Tuscola High School, shared that the generous donation from the alumni covers a wide array of essential needs for the chapter. Our FFA alumni gave us $10,000 to use for competitions, FFA jackets, conferences, field trips, basically anything we need in order to run our FFA chapter, Schoon said. It's a huge help because our chapter couldn't run without the fiscal FFA alumni. Every single year they donate money for us to run our chapter, especially for those kids who might not be able to find their way to events like the Green Hand Conference or the Ground Zero Conference, which can cost $150. She went on to emphasize that the support provided by the alumni extends to vital programs like the FFA Leadership Camp, state conventions, national convention, and the annual FFA banquet. They help us cover these expenses, or like for the FFA Leadership Camp, state convention, national convention, and the banquet. Without this help, we would not be able to attend these events, students continued. The donation from alumni is essential in ensuring that all students can participate, even those with financial constraints. Without this money, the kids who are less fortunate wouldn't be able to participate as much, Schoon explained. It would be unfortunate if we didn't have it. They make so much possible for us. Each year, Schoon submits an expense report detailing the chapter's anticipated costs. She noted that the chapter typically spends about $8,300 a year on its various activities. I fill out an expense report each year and submit it to the alumni. It usually totals around $8,300, and then they round up to $10,000 out of generosity, Schoon explained. This assures that the Tuscola FFA chapter has funds needed to operate successfully and offer a variety of educational opportunities to its members. In addition to event costs, the donation helps to cover the expenses of supplies, such as those needed for the chapter's greenhouse sale. The alumni help with supplies for the greenhouse sale, which are necessary for the students to be able to run that project, Schoon said. The annual financial support from the alumni also alleviates the need for constant fundraising. If we didn't have this money, we'd have to do a lot more fundraising, Schoon explained, and that would really cut into our competition time. It's hard to constantly be going after the same people, fundraiser after fundraiser. With the alumni's help, we only do one fundraiser a year, which is our strawberries. The community really expects that, and they enjoy getting these strawberries. It makes fundraising easier, and it keeps the kid from having to constantly ask people for money. Schoon stressed the importance of the alumni's continued support in helping students remain engaged with the program. We wouldn't be able to do half the things we do without this support, she said. The kids who are less fortunate wouldn't be able to participate as much. It really makes a difference in allowing us to offer these experiences to every student. The Tuscola FFA chapter has about 110 members, with 35 to 40 of them being highly active. We're an affiliated chapter, so technically anyone in the ag class is an FFA member, Schoon explained, but I still have to remind students that they are in the FFA and they can come to anything. It doesn't matter if they don't go to the first meeting, we welcome everyone to join and participate. While many students at Tuscola High School are not from traditional farming backgrounds, shockingly, the number of kids involved in the agriculture industry is really low compared to what you would think, Schoon said. About 90% of my students don't have any direct connection with a working farm. Some live in town and haven't come from a farming background, but they still have a passion for agriculture. The chapter offers a range of experiences to help students discover where their interests lie within the agricultural industry. I always encourage the kids to take an intro ag class first because it gives them the basics of FFA and a glimpse into the ag industry, Schoon said. After that, they can explore different sections of agriculture through career development events to help them find out what interests them. Some may be drawn to ag business, agronomy, mechanics, or food science. It helps them figure out what they want to pursue. Beyond the financial support, the alumni also help students connect with the real-world agricultural industry. We've been able to get students into actual farms so they can drive a combine or a tractor and really see what farming is about, Schoon said. The alumni support goes beyond money. It's about providing opportunities and opening students' eyes to the possibilities within the agriculture field. The Tuscola FFA chapter also encourages students to engage in service learning projects, with some ideas coming directly from the students. The alumni support allows us to do more community involvement without the constant pressure of fundraising, Shun said. We've had ideas like a Christmas tree recycling program where students would collect Christmas trees and donate them to a fish farm. It's just one example of the kinds of projects the students come up with, and the alumni help fund these ideas. The alumni also support Supervised Agricultural Experiences, SAEs, where students create and manage their own agricultural-related projects. If a student doesn't have money to start their SAE project, we can offer a little bit of grant money to help them get started, Shun said. It's a huge help for the students who need financial support to pursue their projects. Since Shun started as the FFA advisor 3 years ago, the program has seen a steady increase in student involvement thanks in part to the ongoing support of the alumni. When I first started, there were only about 6 kids at the first chapter meeting. My first year was really about rebuilding, and now we've been able to grow, she said. The alumni have been an integral part of that growth. We work closely with them at events like our auction, where the students interact with the alumni, and it creates a strong connection between them. Shun also shared how the alumni help create an engaging environment for students to stay involved. The alumni sponsor our meals at chapter meetings, and we get kids at the door with free food and games, she explained. Once they're here, we lock them in by reinforcing the positive experiences they're having and showing them what FFA is really about. The continued generosity of Tuscola FFA alumni ensures that the chapter can maintain a thriving and dynamic program, allowing all students to benefit from the valuable experiences. We wouldn't be able to do this without them, Shun said. We're incredibly thankful for everything the alumni do. They are such an important part of our chapter's success. We'll move now to the obituaries. Neil Howard Baker, 77, of Champaign, formerly of Arcola, died at 6:19 a.m. on Sunday, February 2, 2025. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Thursday, February 6, at the Schrader Funeral Home, 204 North Locust Street, Arcola, with a funeral service at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will follow in the Arcola Cemetery. Susan Ellen Bursa, 73, of Arthur, died at 12:08 p.m. Sunday, January 26, 2025, at Richland Healthcare and Rehab in Olney. Celebration of life services will be held a later day, Schrader Funeral Home, 431 South Vine Street, Arthur. It's assisting family with arrangements. Gladys Thelma Stewart, 90, of Arthur, died at 6:08 a.m. Sunday, January 19, 2025, at the Arthur Home. Visitation was held Saturday, January 25th at Schrader Funeral Home, Arthur. Funeral services followed on Saturday at the funeral home with Pastor Jill Bunker officiating. Burial followed at the Arthur Cemetery. The next article, Nightly Reading, a Family Literacy Event by Nightly Reading Team. This work, CUSD number 305, launched its 6th annual District Book Club, Nightly Reading, a Family Literacy Event. The youngest family member of K through 5 grade students received a copy of Crenshaw by Catherine Applegate to bring home and read together with their families. This novel is an unforgettable and magic story about family, friendship, and resilience. This year's book allows for 3.5 weeks of reading, enjoyment for students and for families, and there are plenty of activities planned at school to enrich the reading experience. To kick off the literary program, students gathered in an assembly to meet Eli Imlay, an educator from Champaign County Humane Society. He talked about pet adoption and care and brought in special furry friends for the students to meet. Reading aloud at home is valuable because it better prepares children to be effective readers, but it also is fun, a worthwhile family activity. With Nightly Reading Program, we aim to build a community of readers at the schools in our district. Additional copies of the book are available upon request from the school. This program is made possible in part by the District 305 Education Foundation and prepared by the Nightly Reading Team of Chrissy Patterson, Title I, Atwood Hammond Grade School, Lindsay Herring, Library Aide, Atwood Hammond Grade School, Jan Harris, Title I, Arthur Grade School, Jennifer Schrock, Library Aide, Arthur Grade School, Amy Teague, Math, Lovington Grade School, and Renee Brown, District Librarian. The next article, Illinois students remain at or above national average. The nation's report card shows achievements still not recovered from the pandemic, by Peter Hancock, Capital City News. Fourth and eighth grade students in Illinois generally scored as well or better than the national average in reading and math, according to results of the latest round of national test results. But their scores remain below pre-pandemic levels, and in the case of reading, continue to decline steadily. The results also show significant achievement gaps in Illinois between racial and ethnic groups, especially between white and black students, which are among the widest achievement gaps in the country. The National Assessment of Educational Progress, often referred to as the nation's report card, is a set of standardized tests administered every 2 years to a representative sample of fourth and eighth grade students nationwide. The program is mandated by federal law and is managed by the National Center for Education Statistics within the U.S. Department of Education and the Institute of Educational Sciences. Because the tests are administered uniformly nationwide, it allows for accurate comparison between states and over time. However, because it is administered to only a sample of students, the results are largely to a margin of error, and so many minor differences between one set of scores and another are sometimes not statistically significant. In Illinois, the 2024 tests involved approximately 150 schools and 2,700 to 2,800 students per subject for each grade. Eighth grade. Results of testing done in 2024, which were released Tuesday, show that among eighth grade students in Illinois, the average math score rose 2 points to 277 out of 500 compared to 2022. That was 5 points higher than the national average, which was down 1 point from 2022. But both state and national averages were lower than they were before the pandemic in 2019. The averages were also below their peak more than a decade earlier in 2013, when the average score in Illinois was 285, 1 point above the national average at that time. Illinois also saw an increase in the percentage of students scoring the top two achievement categories in math, advanced and proficient. Nearly one-third of those tested in 2024, 32%, scored at or above the proficient level in math. That's the level at which eighth graders can solve Pythagorean theorem problems and solve problems involving capacity, area, and weight, according to NAEP officials. There was a 5 percentage point higher than in 2022 and 5 points higher than the national average. The percentage of Illinois 8th graders scoring at or above the advanced level also rose to 11%. That's the level at which a student can perform tasks such as analyzing and critiquing graphical displays to justify appropriateness and solve problems according to test officials. The average Illinois 8th grade reading score, meanwhile, stood at 262 points, unchanged from 2 years earlier, and slightly above the national average of 257. In a statement, Governor J.B. Pritzker said these scores for 8th graders were cause for celebration. Illinois students are proving that we've always known that we support our kids, our schools, the kids thrive, he said. The 2024 National Report Card shows our 8th graders outperforming the national both on math and reading, a testament to the great strides Illinois students are making academically. Fourth grade. There was less cause for celebration, though, in results from the fourth grade exams, where average reading scores dropped both in Illinois and nationally to 214. That was a 4-point drop over 2 years in the average Illinois score and a 2-point drop in the national average. Further, both the state and national averages had been on a steady, continuous decline since 2015, when the Illinois average was 222 and 1 point higher than the national average. According to the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees the assessment, no state saw gains in the NAEP reading scores in either fourth or eighth grade. There was no change in the fourth grade math score in Illinois, which stood at 237. Only 30% of those taking the test scored at or above the proficient level, down 3 percentage points from 2 years earlier. Achievement gaps. The 2024 results also showed significant achievement gaps among different subgroups of students in Illinois. In fourth grade math, for example, there was a 32-point gap between the average score for white and black students, 248 for white students versus 214 for black students. Only Wisconsin and Washington had statistically significantly wider gaps. Eighth grade math assessments had a similar 32-point gap between the average score for white students, 286, and black students, 254. Only three other states in Washington, D.C. had statistically significant wider gaps. The gap between white and Hispanic students at 23 points was slightly smaller but still significant. Only five other states in Washington, D.C. had statistically significant wider gaps. There's an article, Accounts Vary on Valentine's Day Origin. Valentine's Day is a bright light in the middle of winter. Come February 14th, sweethearts celebrate their love and affection for one another on this day devoted to happy couples. The origin of Valentine's Day has generated much speculation over the years. Most early accounts do not point to heart-shaped boxes filled with chocolates. Rather, a few distinctive tales may paint the picture of early Valentine's Day, and they have nothing to do with stuffed animals or romantic dinners. Roman Festival. One of the earliest records of the term Valentine's Day is traced to the Roman festival of Lupercalia, which was a fertility festival. This annual event, held on February 15th, included animal sacrifice and priests called the Luperci, who would take pieces of animal hide and touch them to the foreheads of women in the hopes it would make them more fertile. Fortunately for the squeamish and the sacrificial animals, Pope Gelasius I ended Lupercalia and replaced it with St. Valentine's Day by the end of the 5th century. Two or three St. Valentines. Most people attribute the origin of Valentine's Day to the holiday namesake St. Valentine, but it seems that Valentine was the surname of a few different individuals. According to History.com, the Catholic Church recognizes at least three different saints named Valentine or Valentinus. One Valentine was a priest during the reign of Emperor Claudius II, who decided that single men made better soldiers than those with families or wives. Claudius outlawed marriage for young men. Valentine disagreed with the decree and would perform marriages in secret. Others believe it was St. Valentine of Terni, a bishop beheaded by Claudius II outside of Rome, who was the true namesake. Yet another Valentine may have been jailed and fell in love with a jailer's daughter while in prison. He purportedly wrote to her, beginning the first Valentine's card or letter tradition. Other stories say imprisoned Valentine actually was writing to a blind woman he purportedly healed and signed the note, "Love from your Valentine." It is hard to know who is who in regard to the name Valentine, as the stories and people behind them are used interchangeably. Some historians believe that they actually are the same person rather than different Valentines, where others insist there were multiple martyred individuals. However you slice it, the defiant action of one or more people named Valentine set the course for centuries of romance to follow. Another article, Mattoon Industrial Corridor receives nearly $3 million grant. The Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, DCEO, has approved a DCEO Site Readiness Infrastructure Grant for total project cost of $2,900,000 for electrical capacity near the 100 North Mattoon-Charleston Industrial Parkway Corridor. The City of Mattoon is partnering with Kohl's together with EDO, Ameren, Illinois, and Agricell Incorporated proposed a critical electrical infrastructure upgrade to an electrical substation that services Agricell's Mattoon Enterprise Park. This upgrade is essential to overcoming the insufficient electrical capacity that has hindered the park's ability to attract new industrial developments for nearly two decades, and would directly benefit the area for attracting new businesses, turning Mattoon Enterprise Park into a shovel-ready, pad-ready, prime industrial site. Additionally, this upgrade of utility infrastructure is specifically identified in the Coles County 5-year strategic plan for the general economic development priorities of Coles County. The project ensures the site will become shovel-ready, creating a competitive industrial hub in East Central Illinois. The total project cost is $2,900,000, with the City of Mattoon requesting $2,300,000 from DCEO and contributing a 20% match of $589,000 that will equally share between the City of Mattoon and Kohl's together with EDO. As the electrical capacity is utilized at this development site, Ameren, Illinois will reimburse the match to the City of Mattoon and Kohl's together EDO. And finally, there's an article, Sideline Scoop by Ben Crane, Adjustments Key for this Illinois Basketball Squad. I think every Illini fan that follows men's basketball team closely, especially over the Brad Underwood tenure, knows one thing is for certain. Underwood is one stubborn son of a gun. When it comes to identity, he wants to see grit, intensity, and emotion in every aspect of the game. Some guys have it, others don't, and have to learn it. The current Illinois squad has some players who need to learn it. However, Underwood's stubbornness can sometimes get in the way of his own goals for his team. Kasparis Daciunas, Ben Humericus, and Trey White are three great examples, as these three players had an unfortunate stretch of lackluster performances. Underwood, as every decent coach should, defended the team and continued to play them. But in a must-win game against Ohio State on Sunday at the State Farm Center in Champaign, Underwood finally made an adjustment that ultimately resulted in a win, put the season back on track. Daciunas, Humericus, and White, the most important minutes near the end of the game. Underwood riding with the hot hand of Will Riley, Dre Gibbs-Lehorn, Kylan Boswell, Marez Johnson, and Tomislav Isevich played off dividends as the five turned a 10-point deficit into a 10-point win. It is my understanding that learns that it's okay to not stick with your guns when your guns are jammed. If there's any hope to win a regional season Big Ten championship or go deep into March Madness, this Illinois team must get an insatiable hunger and to be a junkyard dog in the court. If there's anything I've learned over Underwood's tenure is this, in Brad we trust. We have time for a few briefs. Legion Spaghetti Dinner. Tuscola American Legion Post 27 will be hosting a Sweetheart Spaghetti Dinner on Saturday, February 15th. Dinner will be served at the Tuscola Community Building from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Tickets can be purchased from Post 27 members. Tuscola Sons of the American Legion Squadron 27 will also have a silent auction that proceeds benefit Children Welfare Association and the American Legion program. For more information about the auction will be in next week's Chronicle. Meet the VG candidate, meet the candidates for mayor, meet and greet February 8th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Zest for Life Center. And that is all the time we have for this week. This is Chris Yerkes saying goodbye and see you again next week.